Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we recorded November 4th, 2020, we're speaking with Canada's Chief of Defense Staff, General Jonathan Vance. This is part two of our conversation. So what you've described to me, to try and kind of roll it down to a couple of different distinctions. So we've been on a trajectory where Canadian military operations abroad have become increasingly multi-domain or pan-domain or whatever's the right adjective to trying to fuse the different elements of conflict now. And we've seen for a while now, including when you spent considerable time in Afghanistan, trying to combine the different elements of national power in an overseas context to try and to get more coherent effects overseas, combining diplomatic, economic assistance, intelligence functions. In other contexts, you've talked about a significant multi-100% increase in Canadian domestic Canadian Armed Forces operations. But I think those are more about consequence management and response to environmental disasters. What you're describing here, though, is kind of a confluence of the international and the domestic, but in a different way. So you're talking about a scenario, and you've also mentioned previously that we've for a long time operated in a paradigm where we've operated from a safe continent and a safe homeland, but that's potentially evolving. So you've got need to take some of the multi-domain functions, integrating the new spaces in conflict, information domain, cyber, space, and bringing that to at least parts of the homeland and working in a homeland context where there's a less clean division between conflict and peace, as you were laying out. What does that mean at a high level for how the Canadian Armed Forces operates in a domestic context? Or if you're always going to have responses to forest fires and floods, but that's not, I don't think, what you were really describing here. And I don't know that we've been spent a lot of time thinking about the need to have all those different elements of national power at play in a defense context, the way that you've described them, to potentially respond to a threat from overseas. So how does the Canadian Armed Forces work in that context? How do you integrate those other types of domains within Canada or within a continental space in a way that we haven't before? Things like cyber, which you don't have quite clear delineations between defensive, offensive, different aspects of information domain and how you employ that. And then what does that mean in terms of how you work with the other agencies and instruments of Canadian national power protecting Canada in a domestic space, but in a way that I don't think that we've really had a lot of discussion about how we would approach that?
Yeah. Well, that's a PhD dissertation that you just asked me to deliver. I'll try and be brief. I would preface my remarks with, it's an interesting dynamic as I work with colleagues at senior level in government, where we're now dealing amongst each other with a generation that sort of grew up through that Afghanistan period. And, I've only been CDS for 5 years, and so I can't judge what it was like before, but there is a great deal of synergy and understanding of the pan-domain nature of the threats facing Canada, particularly amongst colleagues and senior leaders in the security departments, but also across departments and within government and at the political level. It's very clear, I think, in the main, the type of challenges we are facing and the potential and pitfalls of these blurring lines between domestic and international. And even, quite recently, there's been, commentary about how it is that we roll inside Canada as we try to bring our best capabilities to bear to do the right thing, but, potentially triggering concerns about Canadian use of military power inside Canada that we shouldn't. And I have those concerns too. And those are very legitimate things to be talking about. I've been very clear and issued guidance and direction that we won't do any and have done no operations for the purpose of operational output in those new domains against Canadians ever. And we are going to take steps to not only ensure that that doesn't happen, but design ourselves to ensure that that doesn't happen so that there are plenty of safeguards. Notwithstanding, we have to be able to build capability inside Canada that would be used outside Canada against an adversary. I think the specter now of having to have the ability to defend North America and indeed, in an apocalyptic scenario, fight for North America raises the specter of having to be able to deliver effects from Canada to an adversary who's reaching us with long-range fires. And of course, it's up to the government as to how we would fight that fight. But I've got to be able to give them a range of options, which would include offensive action against a nation that amongst and with allies, against the nation or nations that are bringing that to bear on us. So we can't eliminate that. And whether that is in cyberspace or in physical space or indeed cognitive space, we need to be able to contemplate that. But those instruments are never to be used by Canada and the Canadian Armed Forces against Canadians. I think it's easy to misinterpret intent about marketing and research about accessing populations within and without of the armed forces to encourage recruiting, to encourage behaviors based on the values that we have, you know, inside the armed forces, you know, against racism, against sexual misconduct, and so on. Easy to confuse those skill sets with those that might aim to, you know, modify behavior for some nefarious reason. We don't do that, and I have no intention of ever doing that. But because of the commentary and the interest, which is legit and valid, we need to do a better job of cleaning up our language, cleaning up our documentation around it, and making clear that as we wrestle with new concepts, as something is in the beginning phases of coming forward, it doesn't represent the armed forces' answer. It is simply staff working on things. And until it gets blessed by me, it's not, or the CDS, and the levels up through the CDS, and many things on the deputy side of the house as well, until it gets signed off, resourced, and trained and put in place, yeah, that's not how we roll. But I want to assure you that it's very clear, and your listeners, it's very clear in my mind that there is a definite separation between that which we would do against an adversary, wherever they are, and that which we do in Canada to protect Canadians, and that we do not target Canadians for anything other than, you know, fairly benign recruiting efforts and, you know, a reinforcement of the values that we hold dear, so that people can see us as we would like to be seen, as I think we are. But I've got to tell you that means that we must be able to train and create those capabilities and practice those capabilities so that we can bring effects to bear against an adversary or in adversarial conditions where there's not necessarily a clear-cut adversary, but we're trying to legitimately dominate, whether it's physical space or otherwise, so that at least what we are trying to do can be heard. I had a conversation recently, I won't say who with, but a person I respect, that reminded me one of the most strategic things we did in the information domain in Kandahar or in Afghanistan as a whole was to be first with the truth. And that was quite strategic because if you were second to the Taliban and they were able to torque the message, then of course you weren't there. So first with the truth in a transparent way, with an element of great certainty that you could prove, you know, through any manner of ways, including imagery, those had tremendous strategic effects. And so sometimes it's not an awful lot of wizardry that is going on to produce a strategic effect. Sometimes it's plain old good communications or plain old good application of firepower or any range of things we're doing. What's interesting to me is people measure, you know, how we did in Afghanistan. We were always victorious in those kinetic fights where we could bring force to bear against their force, we were victorious. But ultimately, though, that action was not why we were there. We were there to use actions like that to set conditions for ultimately the government of Afghanistan to be able to reach its people and govern in relative safety. That's lost on a lot of people as they judge warfare. This is all about the Afghan people being able to decide what it is they want, free from coercion that they did not want. And as we watch the Afghan peace process underway, we'll see how that goes, whether or not the end result of all of this is some, you know, franchise in place for the Afghan people to decide or not. Are they still being decided for by warlords and, you know, groups like the Taliban? But that's certainly why we were there and why we used combat power as frequently as we did, because we needed to, because the security environment was there. So in a place like Afghanistan or anywhere else we are, Mali, you know, wherever we are, we will bring to bear all the instruments that we are authorized to in terms of intelligence and in terms of influence so that we can conduct our operations safely, as safely as we can, and we achieve the objectives we want. Influencing behavior in Mali involved things like don't shoot at helicopters. You know, it seems kind of simple, but, you know, if you're surprised by a great big helicopter coming over the hill, you don't know if it's good or bad, telling them who we were and what we were there for so that they don't shoot at helicopters was important. At the same time, being able to engage in legitimate intelligence activities so we understood what the threats and risks were. And while we also understood from a wider intelligence perspective back here from Canada and with our allies about what was going on in the Sahel in terms of the movement and capacity of violent extremist groups and where their interests were, allowed us to tune the operation better. And that's how we roll. We cannot ever have a crossing of that divide so that somehow people in Canada would think that we would be bringing any of this to bear on Canadians. It's a big no. It's not what we do. Yeah, there's been a couple of mistakes recently, and we acknowledge that and are working on it and trying to make sure it doesn't happen again. But at no time was there an intent to bring any effects to bear on the Canadian population. This is us doing our thing to inform ourselves so we can do better work. But it is a matter of concern for us too. And as we get into that pan-domain environment, of course, it's tricky. What are the limits of cyber defense and cyber offense? What are the limits in space? All of this is set by law and government legislative frameworks, all of it, Bill C-59 and all the rest of it. Much of it is governed by the powers of other government departments that we are trying to support. We can't bring to bear military power on a task that we've been assigned to support another department unless they have those powers too. They just need more of it from us. And so it is fundamentally the job of the CDS and senior leadership to ensure that we are walking exactly the right line. And notwithstanding mistakes or those things which are actually righteous acts but could be misperceived, it's our job to make certain that we absolutely on the right side of the law, always. On the right side of perception too. Perception being reality. I think we need to communicate more about this. I think we need to, as I said from the very beginning, the ability to engage legitimately in informed debate is critical, I think, and more critical than ever for those not only in uniform, but those who are informed in or out or having been in uniform or not, academia especially, to have these discussions and then look at the facts of what we do. What is signed? What is legitimate policy? What is actually being done versus, you know, things that are sort of in germination?
So you had talked about, just quickly there, a couple of aspects about the role of the position of the Chief of Defense Staff. So you have, by my calculation, done that particular job longer than anybody else has. So I guess I'd ask you to touch a little bit about how you've seen that position evolve and how it fits within the wider defense, bureaucratic, national security architecture of Canada. So by my count, you've worked with two different deputy ministers as Chief of Defense Staff. And I say this recognizing that you spent time in Ottawa working on other positions that would have given you exposure to these other people in the architecture to a varying extent. Also worked with four full-time national security advisors. So what is the current job of the Chief of Defense Staff envision in that strategic level interaction with other parts of government, with the political government today? And how do you see that the position evolving going forward, recognizing some of these issues that you just touched on, the interplay between defense and other aspects of national power, and some of these other elements of engagement of different types?
You know, having not been the CDS before, I was a CDS, so I can only, I do compare notes with those who came before. And I think the position in terms of what it's responsible for and how that happens has stayed like really consistent. That group of former CDSs that I meet and, you know, I know them all well and personally, I think it's more of the same. Sometimes the issues are different, but the basic role hasn't changed. But we can't deny that the world is changing around us. So there may have been times when CDSs were not able to work in an environment where colleagues at the sort of deputy level within government had such an acute awareness and understanding and need for the use of military power as frequently or as common as it is right now. You know, we've got the Afghan experience behind us, got the standard partners that we've always had, but now you can add those who understand the value of military readiness in the health department, you know, and in interprovincial affairs, so intergovernmental affairs, you can add them to the list. So I think that I can't say best time ever to be a CDS, but I can tell you straight up that there is a wide understanding of the value of the military. There's a wide understanding and respect given to the advice of the CDS. there is a wide understanding that we do our research, we do our homework, and when advice is brought forward, either to amongst colleagues or to the political level, that it's serious and considered, and you know, we put a lot of work into delivering, you know, preparing, delivering that advice. At the same time, I think that the world has evolved. So I'm probably the first, if not one of the first CDSs that sort of operated at the same time as a wildly expanding social media domain was going on. And what that means in the information domain as it relates to some of the priorities I've laid out. And both in terms of adversary and in terms of how it is that we try to get our message out about the armed forces and recruiting and what it is that we're trying to achieve. It is, I think, you know, we're an organization that is trying to improve on the cultural side. So we'll launch Operation Honor and, you know, be giving it our best shot. And on a project or a program that's going to take generations to get right, there's an OAG audit 2.5 years later that says, hey, you're not done yet, or you're not doing what you said you'd do. And so, okay, you know, that's a lot of interest on this, and so we got to double our efforts and so on. So, you know, it's all good, but the external stimulus to consider things on the inside of the profession of arms, I think has always been there, but I would say it's amped up pretty much right now. Some of it, we've done it to ourselves on purpose. And, you know, with the changing demographics of Canada, the changing nature of conflict, and therefore the ability for more people to legitimately access military operations, regardless of strength and, you know, the kind of template that we used to select people for and from, that's important. Because should we fail to access the widest demographics that we can in this country, should we fail to embrace the notion of diversity, we will fail, period. It is a matter of survival, and it's a matter of the right thing to do. And so it's a matter of operational excellence. Why would we deny ourselves of the best person for the job, particularly while the job is changing? And so we're not going to deny ourselves, and we are going to set some lofty ambitions. We intend to meet them as best we can. And David, I'll tell you, I would rather be accused of setting a high bar and failing to meet it than setting a low bar and clearing it easy. I couldn't do any other way, and no CDS in the past would. Nobody wakes up in the morning and thinks they're going to be just a little bit good today. We're going to try to be the best we can. And that is, you know, how we roll. We have, I think, all CDSs have in common, and it's a military virtue, I think, is a bias to action. And so we take the action that we must take. We must also be able to bring to bear a challenge function. Ultimately, CDS is the final judge on so many things. Lots of staff support and staff work, but ultimately it comes down to the CDS. It always has. But this bias to action is very important. It's something that we all hold in common. And if the country needs us, or if we think we need to give advice because we think the country's going to need us, then we do that. We have staff systems and structure to do that. So my sense is that there's far more commonality in terms of the essence of the role, and it's the environment that changes. I've been very fortunate, and I think where you could, you know, determine the difference between how it was for a CDS between CDSs. You know, we're all different, but in terms of the environment we are in, but it was very clear to me that there's some things that we needed to change. And I'd been developing these thoughts and for over years. We all sort of grow up through the ranks. You have things you'd like to get done, and you do them as best you can in the command you have. But, you know, sometimes things need to move on an institutional level. And so I was, you know, given that opportunity. And then the opportunity was, I think, kind of put on steroids as a function of the development of the defense policy, where I was allowed to be an active participant. I think there were CDSs in the past that were not allowed to be active participants in the development of defense policies and white papers, you know, or their role was limited to, you know, a role in advice, and then, you know, it would be taken away. I got to be an active participant, got to help shape it. And ultimately not my decision on what was put into it, but I think that some key things in there, care for the troops, the ability to have some measurement by which our force structure could be based upon, so the concurrency of operations, that sort of modeling, kind of connection between output You know, if you can't have an outcomes-based policy, at least want an output-based policy, because if it's just activity-based, it's only as good as that activity. So, or as long as that activity lasts. So an output-based policy tied to money in a transparent way. Very, very fortunate. And that then gave us the platform to launch with the resources coming, and those resources have started to flow. It's this year that the resources really started to flow, allowed us to begin to really move the yardstick. So we've had some years in planning, and now we're looking at the execution. And now with an impetus to get on with NORAD modernization and continental defense, you know, I call it the other half of the defense policy. It may not be the full half, but it's significant and fundamental to the effective fielding and force posture of the armed forces. That was and has been an incredibly productive environment to work in, where we're growing and we're allowed to think through all of those challenges going forward, where many CDSs had to, you know, although the job was the same, they were presiding over effective and as intelligent as possible cuts and reductions. What I found interesting is that we had all sorts of DNA in this headquarters about how to manage cuts and how to shrink and how to do more with less, but we have not had to develop a lot of DNA over the years about how to grow, how to take risk, how to move through rapid procurements to achieve agility, and there's just so much in this space that comes with the challenge for growth. We are extremely good at managing sort of a flat line, and I think we developed some great expertise around things like transformation, where you're going to do the right thing, but you're really shrinking in terms of your resources. Transformation while you're growing, a little bit harder, because the need to transform isn't just based on resources available. The need to transform is based on other stimuli that's, you know, incredibly important, and we can't ignore it. And so we're going through a transformation in the fielding of the force, but also the back end of the business. If you're an organization that has spent a lot of time trying to preserve core capability, you are required to look at those things which you could deliver but aren't core. Our medical branch is an example. And we've felt this in spades during the pandemic. We have had to, over the decades, chip away at our medical capacity because we couldn't afford to have it, and we needed to be able to field a balanced force. So garrison field balancing of that capacity was wildly skewed just to field deployment, and that's to take care of us, the troops, as they're deployed. In a pandemic, when you're not necessarily taking care of yourself, but you're taking care of others, there's not a lot of spare. We didn't have that resident clinical capacity that was clearly surplus. Now, we're not in the business of developing surplus, but we have, I think, underinvested in some of those enabling functions because we had to. And now we're having to reinvest in them, certainly invest in new capabilities in the domains that we've talked about. And that will, even with additional resources that may come with NORAD modernization, that may mean that there is going to be some reduction in other capabilities that aren't as necessary at the scale that we have right now going forward. And this has to be based in logic and strategic planning and, you know, informed by scenarios, informed by allies, informed by, you know, how it is that we can derive Canada's global posture and arrive at conclusions that with some optionality and provide government those options and then move forward. So I think every CDS has had to preside over that sort of work. Everybody's different. They bring their own personality and skills to bear, but, you know, every CDS has had to do some invention. I've been quite fortunate. It's been an environment where it's been required. There's been a lot of need for visioning. But at the same time, the scrutiny, important, valued scrutiny from outside defense into defense, from Marie Deschamps to all of those who would make comment about who we are, how we are, the various systems we have, all of that incredibly valuable, because what it does is it provides us input. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with the premise always, but nonetheless, if it's an issue, it's an issue. And it has equally been for me a pretty rich environment to find, you know, what are the areas, not just from outside defense, but from our own troops. And so most vexing, I think, is that, you know, sometimes the things that are you'd think would be easy to do to get a good fix in for the troops, it takes some time. And it's not because, you know, anybody's slow rolling us, you know, and if they do, we're usually pretty good at doing the homework to get past it. It's not because we don't get, you know, the kind of support we need, you know, amongst the bureaucracy or politically. Some things just take a lot of time. Rewriting the National Defense Act or parts of it takes time. Rewriting legislation takes time. Changing compensation and benefits, rules and regulations takes time. And it takes a lot of time, years. Now, you know, I didn't know when I took this job, but now I do. It should go faster. I'd like it to go faster. But the only way to make it go faster is to buy more people who write legislation and who can get legislation written. Well, we do that at the expense of other things. So it's a balancing act. I've also experienced, I think, the incredible professional satisfaction that I'm sure comes in varying degrees amongst other, you know, former CDSs about, you know, getting to work not only with the senior leadership, but with the senior leadership in government. I think everybody has a different experience. I've had a very, very good one. And particularly with the bureaucracy, even under two governments, multiple clerks and two deputies and so on. I mean, it's been, you know, very productive and a great part of the job. And it forces you to focus. It is interesting, you know, just because you're military and you've got close to 40 years in, you can't walk into a room and say, well, I said it and therefore it is. Sometimes you have to convince people. And in fact, always have to convince people, particularly if resources are applied or at stake or major policy decisions. So learning to prepare myself to bring cogent arguments with evidence-based analysis to bear, to bring forward, to develop not only the rapport, but the trust that we're going to do this right as an institution has been really good. And it's a great lesson for anybody who wishes to rise to senior leadership in the armed forces where you'll be working in Ottawa, is to be able to, you know, bring that advice to bear faithfully with integrity to the people that need that advice, and then be able to accept where that advice sort of lands and then execute faithfully and loyally. And it's that homework. The thing that struck me the most is the homework necessary, you know, to get the hearing and make your case. It's an important role for a CDS.
Listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries.
Cognizant of your time, I'd ask two questions and before you have to go. The last one being what you're reading, and I'll segue to that. Just ask you, push you a little bit more about your interaction with the political level of government in particular. And so when you're providing that advice, I guess there's kind of a couple of running refrains in Canadian defense circles about our political class. One is that there's far too much partisan division. So you are amongst the other things unique about your tenure as CDS. You were appointed by one government and then served an entire majority of a new government of a different political stripe plus your time to date and going forward. So in your appreciation of interacting with government, is the bipartisan division overstated in your view? Is there more commonality than people think? And then there's also another kind of view that governments, political governments, don't take some of these issues as seriously as folks in the outside world would like them to take. So behind closed doors, is there more partisan agreement from your experience than a lot of people tend to think? And do the political class in this country take these issues more seriously than people have tried to indicate at various times?
I'll answer in a question in a second what I'm reading. I don't really have a particularly good sense of the bipartisan agreement because I'm not really involved where ministers might be speaking with critics and so on. You know, I see it play out just like any other Canadian does. But here's what I do know. Everybody that I have worked with in two governments, in any political job, takes this stuff extremely seriously. I don't know. And the seriousness with which they take it and the attitude that they approach it on, you know, is usually top notch. I mean, they take it seriously. Whether or not they have the same opinion as you or whether or not they disagree with your analysis or not, you know, someone who has a different opinion than you based on their analysis and judgment, who is also taking it seriously, might appear threatening, but they're not. They're taking it seriously and they're supposed to take it seriously. I have been in and amongst decision makers in two governments, and defense and security issues are as serious as a heart attack for all of them. I have not run into anybody of any political stripe that doesn't take things seriously. What they emphasize or how their seriousness manifests itself in terms of policy options, well, hey, that's fair ball. And, you know, I've got no issue with that. My job is to bring, you know, faithfully to the government in power, best military advice. By definition, best military advice based on the analysis that my headquarters and I are able to bring to bear along with, you know, the defense team as we look at things. And in that advice, provide options for government to be able to act on any range of things. Investments in the armed forces through to the employment of the armed forces and anything in between. And I can tell you that in my experience, the CDS always gets a fair hearing. The CDS gets great deference and, you know, respect by all who deal with the CDS. There are occasionally, you know, public displays of displeasure, but, you know, that's our system and that's fine. And, you know, there's an element of contest there. But you asked the question behind closed doors. I have never seen behind closed doors anybody ever say anything where I would walk away thinking that they weren't taking it seriously. They weren't taking the issue seriously. They didn't respect the armed forces. I mean, I just don't run into it. It doesn't mean it's not there. I just don't run into it. I think what happens sometimes is in our democracy, the political level, they bring together a whole bunch of different opinions and they try to arrive at policy choices. And in the to and fro of debate and discussion, some policy options may be something that I don't think would be a good idea. And some I would think would be better. Well, I get asked. I get asked for my advice and I get a chance to weigh in. I get a chance to weigh in either directly to my minister or directly to colleagues and or directly to cabinet or committees. It's a hugely privileged position to be in. I don't see anybody ever not taking things seriously. I also think that the increasing importance of relevant military capacity in a world that's changing quite quickly, where the specter of conventional conflict still exists, while new conflicts and conflict horizons are present, I would say it's quite the opposite. There are, I think, some people in the bureaucracy and in the political level and even out there in Canada that are taking this ever more seriously and indeed have the potential to outstrip our capacity to think broadly and think deeply and act quickly on the things that they're being serious about. And I circle back to my very first point to you. That's why we need informed discussion and debate so that we don't get hung up on parochialisms as we try to move this discussion forward. Terminology is clear and that, you know, not that I'm trying to convince a constituency, but what I am interested in is fair and open debate and understanding that sort of transcends all, you know, average Canadians all the way through to those who are making decisions. And so, yeah, it's an absolutely privileged position to be in. I don't always agree with what I hear. I never hold back if I don't agree. And it's a privileged position to be in. It's all done in confidence, by design. And by doing it in confidence, I'm able to be brutally candid and honest. And I like that.
So while you're being brutally candid, the last question, and I know you have a busy afternoon ahead of you. What are you reading?
Okay, so you're going to ask me this. H.R. McMaster's Battlegrounds, just picked it up. He's a friend of mine, and I got to send that away for him to sign it. I always have two books on the go and multiple books on bedside table. One is always sort of brainy, you know, like a McMaster, and the other is usually about something to do with ocean travel or boating. And right now I'm reading Voyage for Mad Men by Peter Nichols, which is the description of the race around the world under sail in 1968, the first circumnavigation, nonstop circumnavigation. And so kind of sea adventure type stuff. So I'm always reading a couple of chapters each night on those. But right now, Battlegrounds. And I think guy like H.R. McMaster, very interesting fellow. And if you ever get a chance to interview him, I'd highly recommend it. And would like to kind of make the connection if I could, because he's got that unique, and I'd recommend this book, Battlegrounds. He's got that unique connection to academia. He's an incredibly deep and intelligent individual, but has had that experience in the White House, and I think has a reasonably good grasp on some of the, you know, that those macro strategic issues facing us globally and inside our own democracies. And so it is good that we think of things like this, because this is where the power and the authority to use the military comes from, and what you would use it against. And it's something that military leaders at all levels should be thinking about all the time.
General Vance, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I'll leave it pending whether or not the description of a trip around the world is what you plan to do when it is the case that you do retire. But thanks for joining us today on Defense Deconstructed.
Okay, Dave, thanks very much. And thanks to all of you and the CGI members and board for doing what you do. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and leave a comment on your podcast app. And if you like our stuff, please feel free to check out our donation page at cgai.ca/support. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa, and thanks go to our producers, Charlotte Duval-Antoine and Drew Phillips, for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.